Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast, a show for savers, investors, and entrepreneurs, helping you to stay informed, invest wisely, and achieve the unimaginable. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to another edition of the Gordon Asset Management Podcast. This is Todd Zempel, and with me, I have Joe Gordon. Today, we have another very special guest edition of the podcast. Today, we would like to welcome John Doyle with Capital Group. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks for inviting me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. John, before we get into it, can you provide our listeners with a little background on you and where you came from and your role in Capital Group today?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I am, my official title is Senior Vice President and Senior Retirement Strategist for Capital Group and American Funds. And I've been doing this or something similar for really over 30 years, mostly focused on all things related to employer retirement plans, how to make them work better, how to make them help participants in terms of their planning and achieving better outcomes. I've been with Capital Group for 7 years. Before that, I was with a number of other investment managers and retirement plan providers. And so over the years, a lot of what I've done has been both the development of educational programs, but also investment solutions. And, you know, while the education programs continue to work and get better, probably the most impactful change that I've been involved in has been the acceptance of target date funds, and both as a viable solution and also as a default, really starting with the Pension Protection Act. But that's been most of my background for the last 30 some years. It's focused on retirement plans and solutions.
Perfect. Thank you. So you're really, you've been a pioneer on the whole target date fund movement. Can you speak a little bit about that, the history of target date funds in general and QDIA, qualified default solutions?
Yeah, great question. So target date funds were first developed in probably the early 90s. And I want to say somewhere between 92 and 94. They were introduced as an option for participants that they could select them within a plan. They really didn't develop a lot of traction at first. There were a couple of providers who were well known in the retirement space, and they made them available. And that's really all it was. It was an option within a plan that seemed to simplify the selection process for participants. But, you know, a lot of the messaging around investing in retirement plans was around diversification and not putting all your eggs in one basket. So at least at first, what we saw was participants who might, you know, not understand how best to use them and either use multiple options or have a target date as one of many options that they selected. And at the same time, the plan sponsors were still very nervous about putting defaulting participants into anything that had any sort of risk associated with it, because they were concerned to a certain extent about their liability. So the real shift came in the mid-2000s as the Department of Labor started to look at better solutions for participants as they were being moved into retirement plans, where decisions were being made about retirement plans, and trying to move them away from the money market or stable value default, which really wasn't appropriate for somebody in their 20s or 30s. And the real traction for target date then started to build after the Pension Protection Act in 2006, when the regulations changed and the law basically stated as a safe harbor that you could use target date, among others, as what the new QDIA solution. And QDIA stands for Qualified Default Investment Alternative. And it's basically a safe harbor that came through the Pension Protection Act and then was defined by the Department of Labor that laid out what type of investments could be used as a default. And that included target date funds, it included risk-based funds, it included balanced funds, and then managed accounts and other similar solutions. And the real driver behind that regulation was to not default young workers into kind of what might be termed risk-free, not quite, but to a certain extent, but where long-term returns were significantly lower. So I think that's really what started this movement, as you called it, to target dates as being, you know, first of all, in most plans and being the default in most plans. I was looking at some numbers from PSCA recently that I think 81% of plans use a target date as target date fund as their default. And then, you know, the balance is mostly either risk-based or balanced.
Right. And so with 80% of plans offering target date funds, and I would venture to say somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 80% of all new dollars being invested in target date funds. Obviously, the selection of the target date fund in the 401k is vastly, vastly important. So you have to consider things like fees, expenses, philosophy, the investment manager, et cetera, et cetera. When looking at various target date fund providers, what are the key things, the key differentiators in your mind amongst the different target date fund providers?
So, you know, there's kind of high level and then there's under the hood types of differences. I think probably the most common differentiators that people look at are either, is it a two glide path or a through glide path? And I'll talk about that in a minute. Or is the target date fund made up of active building blocks or passive building blocks? And I use the term building blocks because those are the underlying investments that a target date fund invests in. I think most people understand target date, that and most target dates are a fund of funds where they're utilizing other investments, other funds within the target date fund itself. And you know, the difference between an active stock fund and a passive stock fund is pretty clear. The passive stock fund invests in an index. Well, there's really no such thing as a passive target date index. So there's no such thing as a true passive target date. There are active decisions being made around what building blocks to use and what asset allocation makes sense for that particular target date. So the differentiation between active and passive and target dates is really around the building blocks, not necessarily around the fund itself. And then the two versus through differentiation. A lot of the target date funds stop the change in asset allocation at age 65, while others continue to manage the asset allocation beyond age 65. And let me explain a little bit what I mean by that. With a target date fund, when you're younger, so the 2060 or even now the 2065 fund, you're primarily invested in stocks, and that percentage is reduced over time until the glide path stops gliding. And that means basically it's reached its lowest allocation to equity and its highest allocation to fixed income. Many target date funds stop at the target date. So, for example, the 2020 fund hit a static allocation in a two glide path in 2020, this year, great year that it was. Whereas a through glide path will continue to change that allocation anywhere from 5 to 30 years. American funds, we continue to manage it 30 years past the retirement date or the date stated on the fund. Some don't go quite as far as 30 years. So that's the high level differentiation that I think most people look at and understand right off the top of their head. But I think what we found is when you look at how the building blocks are managed and how that glide path is managed and executed, you start to see some significant differences. You start to see where, you know, one solution may simply be have a pool of stock and shrink that as a percentage of the portfolio over time, whereas other managers, and it's one of the things we do at American Funds, but other managers will actually change that pool. So that, and we can get into this a little bit more, but you know, so that what you own when you're 65 in the stock pool is very different than what you owned when you were 35 or 40, and that's just another lever that you can pull to mitigate risk within the portfolio while still managing it to a specific objective. And I'm happy to actually get into a little bit more of how we do that. But then finally, and you pointed it out at the beginning, the fees. And, you know, when you look at these high-level tangible differences. Fees, tour through glide path, and active or passive seem to be the ones that everybody look at. And it's important. Fees are absolutely important. They're tangible. You can measure them at any point. But value for the fee is also important, and understanding what the long-term outcomes will be for participants, and simply going with the least expensive doesn't necessarily bring you the best results. So it's a factor that needs to be looked at. It's part of the decision-making process in terms of what are we looking at, how are we making that decision. So if you look at fees, you look at the type of glide path, you look at active or passive, and ultimately the long-term outcomes and the results for participants in the plan, those are the things that we see as being real drivers at the decision-making level when trying to differentiate between different target date managers.
So, John, this is Joe. What would you say to a retirement plan committee, hypothetically, about how to best monitor the QDIA decision that they've made? What types of factors should they look at? Should they even consider a mini RFP on the QDIA every 3 to 5 years, especially if the performance is competitive, but maybe not the best, or maybe the fees are a little higher than market because things are fairly fluid? And, and obviously for those on that'll listen to this podcast, they're just interested in how to keep out of harm's way with the regulators on how to best discharge their responsibilities as fiduciaries.
So given that what we're, I mentioned earlier, more than 80% of plans are using target date as a default. What's also very important is the cash flow in these plans into the target date. And if, looking at various researchers, and I think including Cerulli is the most recent one I looked at, where, 60 to 80% of new cash flow is going into the target date funds, depending on the plan and depending on a number of other things, which really makes it the most important investment option in the plan. So, you use 3 years. I think 3 years is a good time frame in terms of doing a deep dive, whether it's a mini RFP or a fairly deep analysis of target dates and the markets. I think you can't just set it and forget it. You really need to look and do your due diligence and oversee how that option is doing, how that fund is doing, relative to the reasons that you picked it in the first place. And that includes results, it includes fees, and it includes something we haven't talked about yet, which is risk and volatility. Because if all you're doing is looking at investment performance, then you might be missing some other issues. If all you're doing is looking at fees, you may be missing other issues. And I think one of the challenges that a plan sponsor has when they're making this decision is the being able to kind of benchmark the tangibles and the intangibles. And one of the mistakes that I see being made is simply going for the cheapest, the lowest fee, which isn't necessarily in the best interest of the participant. As a fiduciary, the goal is not to avoid litigation. The goal is to do what's best for the participant. That's your duty as a fiduciary. And one of those things is obviously cost. But that seems to be gaining traction in the press and other areas because that's such a tangible and measurable issue that people can latch onto. But so what I think a plan sponsor, then the decision maker needs to do is obviously take that into account, but also take the value that they're getting and the risk measurements and volatility that actually impact how a participant views it on a day-to-day basis. Because the best results may come from extremely high volatility, and that may be okay, but be aware of that. And I after what we saw in the first quarter, there were a number of investment managers and target dates that struggled a little bit during the first quarter. And my kind of response was, if you expected that because of the level of risk you wanted to take on, then you should be fine and you should be okay. But if you didn't expect it, and if the volatility was greater than you would have thought, then that's part of what you need to do as along with your due diligence. So whether it's every 3 years or it's after the type of year that we've had this year, I think there's real opportunity to do that deep dive into the QDIA. I look at 2020 as probably, an excellent period for a stress test on your QDIA, because we really saw, I don't want to call it a complete market cycle, but we saw a lot going on in 2020, which will give you an opportunity to look at how your QDIA held up during the volatility and downturn in the first quarter, how it came back as the markets recovered, and the recoveries there were often led by growth, and a lot of the growth stocks that led that recovery. So, is that an aberration going forward? That's part of the process in terms of doing that due diligence and overseeing the QDIA. The challenge is, though, that that there's really no benchmark. I mean, you have the S&P benchmark for target date, you have the S&P 2 benchmark, and you have the S&P through benchmark for target date. They're simply average. Morningstar does one too. They're simply averages of all the target date asset allocations, as opposed to a true index. And so there's nothing to compare it to on a one-to-one basis. You need to almost do it in a three-dimensional capacity, where you would have an understanding or an expectation of how your fund might do under certain circumstances, and did it do better or worse than the index as expected? Meaning, if the fund is more conservative in up markets, it should lag the benchmark. And if it's more aggressive in up markets, it should lead the benchmark. So you should always have that multidimensional view when you're looking or using whatever benchmark you choose to use.
So, John, what would you say in the last 18 to 24 months from where you sit have been the primary reasons that your firm has been successful in winning mandates and finals presentations? What are the key differentiators that, other than performance and fees, that you feel like retirement plan committees put weight on to make a decision to hire your firm?
So, one of the reasons is fees are important, and we are the lowest cost active manager for target date funds in the mutual fund space. So I do think that, I know you said other than fees, I do think that's one of the reasons we're at least at the table. And folks are looking at us, but I always tell I tell our sales team, but I also, when talking to a plan sponsor, investment results are important, but that's not where you should start. And I think what you really need to do is take a look at how the fund is managed and the philosophy behind the way the fund is managed. And I think an understanding of what we do at American Funds with our target date has helped drive the selection of American funds in many plans and cash flow into those funds relative to the rest of the industry. So the way we look at it, and I mentioned earlier, Pension Protection Act was passed in 2006, and that's really when target date funds took off. We built our target date funds after the Pension Protection Act. So we actually had the advantage of knowing that they could very well be a default for an individual in a retirement plan, and ultimately they could end up being 100% of someone's investment or retirement savings. So with that in mind, rather than build target date as an asset allocation fund, we built it as a portfolio. So we looked at it from a portfolio construction point of view, and not simply as an asset allocation fund that would be an option in a plan. And in doing that, we kind of looked at it with two primary objectives: build wealth and also preserve wealth. And I think with a lot of asset allocation funds, it's almost an either or proposition, where if you lower the risk, you're lowering the equity exposure, you're lowering the long-term opportunity for growth, but you're preserving wealth. And the approach that we take is to do both at the same time. And let me explain how we do that. Each building block within the portfolio has a specific role, and that role may change over time, but the building blocks change over time. So when you're in the 2055 or 2060 fund, you're generally younger. You can afford to take more risk, and that's the way we've always presented asset allocation and portfolios anyway. But you can take more risk because you have more time to make it up if the markets go down. And truthfully, the younger investors often have less money to lose. As you go move along the glide path, so as you move along your timeline as an individual, you're first of all, you're building wealth. So you have more money. As you approach retirement, you really have the largest pool of assets that you're going to have. And so it's important that you preserve what you've built. But I still think that a 60-year-old or a 65-year-old is a long-term investor. You know, we talk about managing a glide path 30 years beyond retirement. I mean, a lot of those assets have a 30-year time frame. So we want to maintain that equity exposure, but not the same type of equity exposure or stock exposure that we gave the 30-year-old or 35-year-old. So rather than, for example, owning the FANG stocks and you know, owning the more growth-oriented, more volatile stocks that a 30 or 35-year-old, we start to move to more dividend paying, dividend growing, what I call maybe even a more defensive stock position for those individuals as they approach retirement. So we're using that lever to dampen volatility. So we're reducing the risk, making it a little more palatable for participants who are in their 50s and 60s through various stock market cycles. And yet we're still maintaining that long-term outlook and the fact that we need to continue to help the balances grow even after retirement. You know, it's we don't want them going down immediately at age 65. We want to maintain that equity exposure as folks move through retirement. So that's one aspect of what we do differently. And actually, I'll talk about the first quarter in a minute because it was a good example of how that worked. But I don't want to skip over the role of fixed income and bonds, because when you think about it, when somebody's in their 60s, all of a sudden, we're talking about equity and we're talking about, you know, the stocks within the portfolio. Bonds actually make up more than 50% of the portfolio as you move into, or maybe the, you know, as you go into retirement. So one of the things that we do a little differently is we use fixed income for four purposes: diversification from equity as an income producer, inflation protection and inflation shocks, because equity is still the best inflation protection, and then also capital preservation. And we talk about bond funds that act like bond funds. We're not trying to stretch for return on the fixed income side. We're trying to use that as a risk mitigator. We obviously want good results, but we also want to protect the portfolio and protect the equity side of the portfolio with our fixed income. So when you take that defensive stance in the equity side and add to that the bond funds that act like bond funds, in a downturn, we see a lot less volatility than many of our competitors. So in the first quarter of 2020, relative to the largest providers of target dates, our funds really did much better. They were still down. The markets were down at one point. Equity markets were down over 30%. But we were probably 4 or 5% better than most target date fund providers during that period because of the way we manage the underlying building blocks. And I think, back to your original question, what sponsors are starting to understand is that value of the active management underneath the hood in terms of the building blocks, but also that change in the characterization of the stocks and equity and fixed income as you move along the glide path, which goes back to my original point of this is a portfolio, not an asset allocation fund. And as a using portfolio construction, having a portfolio that fits the individual at their point along the glide path has really helped in our results, but it's also helped plan sponsors and decision makers understand where that value is coming from. And that has helped us win in a lot of these situations.
Now, John, those are some really great points, and I couldn't agree more. You know, the fixed income part of the equation. So what's under the actual hood truly makes a huge difference in the portfolio construction. We see many target date fund providers sort of pat themselves on the back and say, oh, because we hold more fixed income bonds, we're much more conservative than the other guys. And then when you actually look under the hood, some of the fixed income that they actually own could be, you know, high yield, wildly volatile type stuff. So, you know, on paper, in a very two-dimensional view of the target date fund and glide path, Some folks think they are very conservatively positioned, but hey, when stuff happens like it did earlier this year, those more volatile type bonds can trade just as wildly as stocks. So that said, John, just curiously, can you construct a situation in your mind where you think just a two glide path would be a better solution for anybody than a through type glide path?
I think there's a little bit of a misperception around two versus through. And I think that, and what I've heard many times is that the reason you would offer a two glide path is because participants leave the plan when they retire and they don't stay in the plan. They don't stay in the target date fund. So, you don't need a through glide path. And I actually disagree on two fronts. One is that even if they leave the plan, they may still choose to roll over with their target date fund or into the same target date fund. So you can't just assume that the money will not be put to work. And you need to take that into account. But I will also offer that's not how or why a two glide path was constructed in the first place. I think that there is a mindset, or not a mindset, but there's a thought at the portfolio management level that a retiree that is no longer receiving income doesn't need a glide path. They simply need a portfolio for the next 30 years. And that's the investment philosophy behind the two glide path. But I think that's often lost. We don't agree. We think that that a participant at age 65, should still have more exposure than their lowest point. But the scenario you asked for or describe would be for an investor or a plan sponsor that agreed that in retirement, a static portfolio with no glide path management made sense. And, I think when we look at the way we do it, we think that makes sense for someone in retirement. It's modeled that way. It's modeled for withdrawals in a real world situation. But the scenario for two would be more just believing that a static portfolio makes more sense. I don't think the argument that people leave the plan, it really should be part of that discussion, because you don't want to. The scenario that would be dangerous in my mind is if you get too conservative at age 65 because you have a two glide path, and that individual retires and goes to an advisor and now has to kind of ramp up their portfolio at age 65 to take the appropriate amount of risk and get the appropriate amount of equity exposure, and they now have created market timing risk, where if they do that at the wrong time, they move out of a two glide path and then into a portfolio with a greater allocation to equity. If the timing's wrong, they could be hurt by that, and they're better off simply on a glide path where they're at the right point, wherever they are on the glide path, when they choose to move to a similar portfolio outside the plan.
So, John, as we wrap up and you look over the horizon in the world of education and portfolio management, what are the things you're thinking about and what are the interesting areas that you are exploring?
So, solutions will continue to evolve in retirement plans. And, I think, as I said right at the beginning, I think we made some really giant steps with the QDIA definition and with target dates, because target dates take a very complex decision-making process from the participant and simplify it for the participant. It's still a complex solution. I think that especially as we see more assets go into target date, we'll continue to see the evolution of these types of solutions, and they will get better. The challenge, I think, is that a lot of the changes that we've seen are changes for the sake of change and changes to differentiate, as opposed to changes for the better. And what we'll see in the future, I think, is ideally changes for the better as well. That may mean more personalization. That may mean more choice for participants. But the challenge with choice is that once you put choice in the hands of the participants, they freeze at times and don't make it. So What I'd like to see and what I see happening is this level, maybe a little bit more personalization for the engaged participant. And there may or may not be costs associated with that. But for the participants that aren't sharing more information, the participants that aren't really that engaged, this type of default solution still works well. And adding complexity really kind of defeats the purpose of what we've been able to achieve. So we'll continue to see evolution, and hopefully evolution for the better. I think we just need to be wary of change for the sake of differentiation and not for the sake of making it a better solution.
Sounds great. Well, John, thank you so much for your time today. It was very insightful to hear your comments on the industry and what you guys at Capital Group and American Funds are doing. So, John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the invitation, Todd.
All right, folks, that'll wrap it up for today. Thanks a lot. And if you have any questions or would like to learn more about American Funds or Capital Group, just Google their name and you'll find their website, no problem. Thanks a lot, folks. Have a good one.
The information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management, LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.